Welcome into another edition of the Dana and Victory podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. I'm Rick. He's Dan. Dan, it's signing day today, and this is usually a crazy day for me. Today, not so much on the signing part of things, but it ends up being crazy nonetheless because of the Brandon Randolph saga that has developed. And I guess basically we can just break this down for everybody.
Well, let's first say this. We're recording this at 10 o'clock, a little bit after 10 o'clock, Eastern Time, PM, on Wednesday. Everything may be different by the time folks are able to listen to this tomorrow morning.
That's a very good point, though I don't expect them to be. And here's why. Basically, Xavier was made aware of Brandon's commitment late last night, early this morning sometime. He decided to commit. He loved Xavier after visiting. He discussed it with his family, made the decision. Around, I believe, it was sometime this evening, I'm going to say, I believe four-ish maybe, he was I guess his dad had been talking to Missouri's coaching staff, and they basically convinced his dad that Brandon needed to visit there before he committed. Now, I'm sure there are going to be conclusions drawn. Here's my best guess at what happened, and of course we don't know exactly. Brandon and his cousin, who was running his recruitment, Shannon Jones, were saying that he is still committed, he loves Xavier, and this is just sort of a formality. Basically, that his dad's whole point was that he doesn't want to kick himself later on, was the quote that they used. To me, this looks like someone from Missouri is in his dad's ear and was able to convince him that, hey, your son has only – I mean, he's never been out to the Midwest really until his Xavier visit. He makes that one visit there, and then you're ready to commit without seeing any other schools and without seeing Missouri, who's recruiting him and offered him. So I guess, you know, they convinced him, hey, it's in your best interest. At least compare Xavier to something else before you make your decision. And – his dad was able to get that done. So at this point, Brandon, I guess, is on board with it. He's going to visit Missouri tomorrow with his father. But, it still looks good for Xavier, I guess, is the point to say. He's still saying he's committed. As Snow mentioned on the board, if this was football, we'd be calling it a soft commitment.
Well, let's I guess we can throw a few things into the mix. First of all, Brian Snow's been all over this matter, and there have been a number of updates posted to the message board and an article just within the hour with the quotes that you mentioned, Rick. I think there's a few things. I mean, obviously, this is an interesting development. There's no telling where it's going to go. Do we know what the visit is going to be Thursday, Friday?
Yeah, I mean, that's the plan right now from what I understand. He's going to Missouri with his father tomorrow, which will be Thursday. And, I mean, imagine they'll be there from Thursday into Friday and come back for the weekend. But at this point, it seems as though Brandon's firmly in the I'm committed to Xavier boat. And he's doing this to please his father, who was convinced by someone on Missouri staff, is my now, best read of the situation at this point.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at the Mizzou schedule. They do have a game on Friday night against Nicholls State at home. So perhaps he sticks around, takes in that game. You know, this is it's sort of last-second drama, but to be honest, this has been a recruitment that's followed a very compacted time frame, as Snow talked about last week. I mean, this kid really became a Xavier target within, 3 weeks? So it's perhaps unsurprising that that members of his, you know, core members of his family, members of his group of advisors want to at least kick the tires on some other schools. I mean, I believe his only other offers as of when Snow was on our podcast, besides Xavier, were Wyoming and Cal State Northridge or something like that. So this interest has obviously turned somebody in his camp's head. The quotes that are coming from his cousin and that ostensibly come from the young man himself seem promising, but I guess we'll know probably this weekend, how this recruitment is going to play out.
Right, and you do bring up a very good point of, that you've got to consider the fact that Xavier just started recruiting him, you know, what, a month or two ago? I mean, it hasn't been long at all. They made a trip out to visit with him. They really liked the kid. He made a visit back to Xavier. Again, everything seems to be going well. They're hitting it off. So I do think Xavier's in a great spot. And again, as you mentioned, there's been so much bad news. Let's not forget that things are rolling pretty well for Xavier right now. I mean, this isn't like the whole Ron Patterson deal a couple weeks ago. You know, I don't expect it to be that type of situation, and it doesn't have that same type of feel. I still think Xavier's in a good spot with Randolph.
Right. Well, with Patterson, it just seemed like he was. It honestly gave me the same feel as the heralded Devontae Smith Rivera recruitment, where it almost just seemed like the kid was waiting for a higher profile for one of the schools on his core list to come and get him. You don't seem to get that feel with Randolph, but. In any event, this is so we're starting off with some recruiting news. We didn't intend to do that, but this breaking news is just occurred this afternoon and this evening. So we're really here to talk about the first week of the XU basketball season, the 2012-2013 schedule. And boy, the Muskies look impressive in their first two contests. They started out last Friday by pummeling Fairleigh Dickinson, final score of 117-75, game that ended with most of the laptops on press row smoking due to the overburden stat sheet programs. And then on Tuesday afternoon, as part of the ESPN kickoff marathon, the Muskies took on now A-10 foe Butler in a non-conference game scheduled game at Cintas Center and really took it to the Bulldogs in a way that I don't think many of the experts would have predicted. I will tell you this, Rick, I checked the line on this game shortly before the game started for educational purposes only, and the Bulldogs were a 5-point favorite coming into the game. So Xavier came out, they won the game 62-47. They weren't really challenged for the last 17 minutes of the game. It was a very exciting performance, I thought, from a fan's perspective, and I'm sure the coaching staff were just as overjoyed with what they saw.
Yeah, let's start with the fairly ridiculous win, because there's not much that you can draw from that, I don't think, but I believe it was your first time on press row, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
That is correct.
What was that experience like? You got to give us a report. What was the experience like on press row?
Well, I'd been there for some high school games before that. It was cool to play some faces with some names from people that I've corresponded with in the past over the past 3-4 years. The experience of being courtside for a college basketball game, especially somebody like me who has always sat in the rafters at Cintas Center in my season tickets, is really it's really an eye-opening one. And I know the students are always close to the floor, and maybe a lot of the subscribers to your site, Rick, are more well-heeled alumni who have seats down there. But for me, I'm down in the lower level of the Cintas maybe once or twice a year. So it's always crazy to me to be that close, see how big the guys are, see how physical the game is and how compacted the game is. The court just seems so small when you get up that close to it and you see the size of the players and how fast they move. So that always is an eye opener for me when I get that close. And it was fun. Got to chat with AD Mike Babinski, some of the media types down there, some of the other folks that make Xavier basketball what it is. So it was kind of cool.
And of course, as far as the game goes, they put up 170 points. They shoot 70% from the field. Not much you can really draw from the performance because they played so well and Fairleigh Dickinson was so bad. But I do think there were a couple things in there that you saw sort of start and then really carry over into the Butler game. And one of those was the performance of D. Davis. And it was 22 points, 15 assists, I believe, which is just an insane stat line. And honestly, that didn't really mean as much to me as just his overall presence on the court, I guess you would say. I mean, there was no question about who the leader of that team was. He was the best player on the court that night. He was shooting threes with confidence. He showed some of that improved shooting touch that we've been talking about on the podcast. He played really, really well and just brought that floor general personality with him. And I thought that was huge, and that really carried over into the Butler game.
Absolutely. And actually, you know, his stat, you can talk about his stat line from the Butler game where he had 9 points, or 2 assists, 2 turnovers and 1 steal in 35 minutes, which doesn't sound that impressive, but quite frankly, I thought that his performance against Butler was almost more assured and almost more critical in the way he played defense than it was against Fairleigh Dickinson, where he really blew up the stat sheet in what was, let's be honest, a glorified AAU game for most of the second half, most of the first half for that matter. I mean, FDU is as bad in their current incarnation with all the players they have out, is as bad a college basketball team as there is in Division I this year. If there's a worse one, I don't want to see them. And, you know, you can't really blame the kids that were out there. You know, I don't know what the cause of all their suspensions was, but they just were – they were in bad shape, and they played terrible defense, and they didn't really seem to have any clue what their roles were on the court. So Xavier was really running their offense almost like they were playing a scout team or almost like with no defense whatsoever. But I think the importance of that game, Rick, was that you saw a lot of guys, not just D. Davis, carry over – the confident way they played against Fairleigh Dickinson into the Butler game. And I'm talking specifically about Travis Taylor, who had 20 points and 12 rebounds against Fairleigh Dickinson, and then followed that up with what is, for my money, his best game as a Xavier player against Butler.
Without question.
And then Brad Redford hit 6 of 7 threes against FDU, came out like a house on fire, came out in the Butler game, shot well, played well, got 22 minutes, was not a liability on defense, did his part. And Justin Martin also played well in both games. So, I mean, I think that FDU game, if there was a function to it, was it gave a lot of guys a big boost of confidence, especially to play that way with the most talented player on their team, Samaje Christen, and a guy in Isaiah Fillmore that everyone expected to be a key cog out in that FDU game. You saw a lot of guys who were sort of on the fringes of the starting lineup get big minutes and big opportunities. In the Butler game, that carried over because I felt like there was a real purpose about the way Xavier played in that game, and we'll talk more specifically about what they did defensively. But I really thought that it was one of the most impressive team performances that I've ever seen from a Xavier team at Cintas Center, because I didn't feel like there was any dissension in the ranks, and I feel like everybody was bought in to everything that the coaches asked them to do, which has not always been the case, even with more talented teams over the past 3, 4, 5 years.
I agree completely. And I think possibly, maybe this is just reaching a little bit, but you look at that FDU game and you mentioned how much confidence they gained from it. And maybe it's not just the individual players. Maybe it's not just Jeff Robinson getting confidence in his shot or whatever, but maybe it gave the guys a lot of confidence and a lot of trust in what the coaches are preaching, saying, hey, you run your offense, you execute the right way, you play a certain way, and this is what happens. You play, I mean, nearly flawless basketball, and that carried over into the Butler game, and I agree. It was not this Butler game was one of the best team performances I've seen since I've been covering the team, but it was also just one of the most locked-in performances. I mean, you want to talk about for 35 minutes on the defensive end, D. Davis was just about perfect. I mean, zero mistakes, never went under a screen, never lost Rodney Clark for an open shot. Everything Rodney Clark got for, he worked for. And he didn't get a whole lot. I mean, he was very, very frustrated. And you're talking about one of the premier scorers in college basketball and maybe the best shooter in all of college basketball.
Well, I looked up, you know, Clark came to Butler this season. He sat out last year. He played 3 years at Arkansas under John Pelfrey. And if you look at his game logs from his last season at Arkansas, which was 10-11, there's some gaudy numbers there. I mean, I'm looking at 36 points against Vanderbilt, 25 against LSU, 21 against Alabama, 26 in an upset win over UK, 26 against Ole Miss in a game Arkansas eventually lost, but one that basically their at-large hopes hinged on, 24 against Mississippi State. I mean, and And this is a guy who, as Chris Mack noted in his postgame comments, this is a guy that put up 51 points in a college basketball game. One of his the first game of his sophomore year against Alcorn State, he had 13 threes in a game. This is an absolutely elite shooter. And I wanted to start with the perimeter defense because I thought that was critical in this game. Can you sort of break down a little bit what you saw that allowed D. Davis, Samaje Christen, Justin Martin, some of the other guys that rotated out on the shooters to really lock down Butler's scoring guards, Clark and Kellen Dunham?
Yeah. Well, one thing Butler does, and I thought we potentially might see a little bit of zone from Xavier, and we've talked about on the board how that's something that they've been working on a little more. And the reason I thought that was because Butler does a really good job of running fairly simple actions, in my opinion, that they're just very good at executing to get their shooters open and freed for good looks. And the reason they're good at it is because their shooters are really good at executing them, you know, setting their men up for a screen before they run off of it. What they're really good is making you think they want to curl a screen so you'll go underneath of it when you're defending it, and then they bounce back, you know, sort of that little pop back motion you sometimes see shooters get where the defender's trying to run around the screen and they pop back, catch it, and the defender's caught behind the screen now, and they hit that open jump shot instead of curling around for a drive or a mid-range jumper. And that's what they really, really do a lot of, dribble handoffs where they sort of dribble right at you and then they stick their butt into you at the last second and pitch it back to the shooter, and your man's too late to help out. A lot of that stuff is what Butler's trying to do. What Xavier did, and what really the only way you can be successful against defending this, it's not some super, it's not big time schematics or anything that you've got to figure out. It's very easy to see what they're doing, but what you have to do is be locked in. You have to be extremely tough, and you have to be dedicated to whatever your game plan is, and you have to trust your teammates. And the guards were really, really good, Dean Samaje. And give Justin Martin some credit, too, because he did a good job on Kellen Dunham at times. They were really good at, one, just being relentless. I mean, they didn't give up on a single play defensively. And it maybe even hurt D's offensive performance a little bit with the way he played on the defensive end. Two, they really, really, really stuck to the game plan. I mean, not once did I see one of those guys go underneath a screen. They knew what Butler wanted to do. The staff did a good job of preparing for it in the couple days, really, leading up to the game. And they bought in, and they never strayed away from the plan. And then the third thing that was really good, and this isn't even the guards as much as it is the forwards, they were there every time the guards needed help, which allowed Dean Samaje to have that kind of trust. I mean, Travis Taylor, Jeff Robinson, Justin Martin, those guys, Eric Stanger even, stepping out. So when they do try to curl that screen, the big man was right there, hedging it, stopping them, cutting them off, deterring the drive to the rim or the easy mid-range jumper. And it really allowed Xavier's guards to follow the game plan exclusively, and it worked out great for him. I mean, like I said, Rodney Clark completely frustrated in that game, in my opinion. And one of the things, the reasons it worked so well is because Butler really doesn't have creators on their team. Unfortunately, they're asking Rodney Clark, because the loss of Krishan Hopkins, to play the point guard position and create for everybody while also be the leading scorer and take the most shots. That's not a good position for any team to be in because, you know, well, I mean, we saw it at times with Xavier last year. I mean, you want Tu Holloway to score the ball, but at times when you're asking your point guard to lead you in shot attempts, you're killing your offense and doing a lot of ball stopping. So I thought there were some problems on Butler's on the offensive end for Butler, but Xavier's defense was really, really good.
And I think the guard play was outstanding, particularly. We'll talk about Samaje Christen a little bit more, but I want to talk about Travis Taylor's game because, you know, a sort of running theme on this podcast over the last, whatever, 6 months since we started doing it has been that for you, for the coaching staff, for the program insiders, you've all been telling us Travis Taylor is a fantastic player in practice and in open gyms, and he has a great motor, and he's confident with the ball, and he finds ways to score around the basket. And we didn't see it last year. Kentucky State game, he struggled. Even the Fairleigh Dickinson game, where he got up to 20 points and 12 boards in the first half, the first couple touches he got, I know he dropped the ball out of bounds. His first touch, shortly thereafter, I think he was called for a walk. This game, first play, he gets the ball in a scramble and puts the ball in the basket. And from there, he proceeded to dominate the paint for the remainder of the game. And even though he was giving up, 4 inches to Andrew Smith, he absolutely did not back down an inch. When he was required to guard some of the talented wings that Butler has, Marshall and Jones, he played them very tough. He dominated the defensive glass. I mean, it seemed like every critical defensive during the big run Xavier went on to extend their lead from 6 or 7 to the high teens in the midsection of the second half. It seemed like he picked off every defensive rebound and was just rising up and had a hand on every loose ball. I thought it was a breakout game for him, and it's one of those you don't want to overemphasize one performance. But if there was ever a time when a kid who's shown the ability to produce at the college level when he was at Monmouth could break out of these doldrums that he's been in since he got to Xavier and start playing up to that potential that everyone believes is there, that seems like a good opportunity.
Well, hell, I mean, you could almost throw Jeff Robinson in the same exact – I mean, just substitute Taylor's name out for Jeff Robinson right now and change a few of the descriptions of the way he scored, and you'd probably have the – I mean, we'd be saying the same exact things. But, yeah, I mean, Travis Taylor, not only did he grab – he had no rebounds in the first half, which is insane to think about because it literally felt like he grabbed every rebound in that Butler game. I mean, that stretch run that they went on, you mentioned it. He dominated the defensive glass. And not only did he dominate the glass, but it wasn't like other guys boxing out and these balls are coming down right to him. He's grabbing the ball above the rim on most of these rebounds. I know Mack even commented, it seemed like he was the highest guy out there every single time a shot went up. And he was. I mean, that part of it, that can be every performance for Travis Taylor, and he has to play that way at the minimum for this team. He has to rebound like that every game because he is capable of it, and that's an effort thing. Now,
Jeff Robinson, I want to talk about too, because that was the most complete performance I've ever seen from Jeff Robinson. He was aggressive. He took the ball to the basket and finished at the rim a couple times. He stepped into mid-range jump shots with confidence and knocked them down. I think he knocked them down from, you know, I know he had a little, he shook his man on a little baseline move and hit an 8-footer in the first half. And in the second half, he had a couple from beyond the foul line, knocked down a 3 in the first half, although he then took a heat check 3 that was maybe a little ill-advised, probably got him yanked out of the game shortly thereafter. But generally, I mean, he looked like, and I brought up this comparison to you in email today, and it's probably going to make me look really stupid, but he reminded me in that Butler game of the Purdue All-American Juwan Johnson, maybe a poor man's version of Juwan Johnson, who was a consensus All-American at Purdue a couple years ago, because Johnson was a 6'10 guy who really played on the wing, could shoot out to the three-point arc, and just had a lot of different ways that he could score the basketball and could finish at the foul line. And that's what you saw out of Jeff Robinson in that particular game. Previous games when Jeff Robinson had big games, and I'm thinking the Iowa game a couple years ago and then the LaSalle game, was that last year or
last
two?
Year.
Last year. It was based on his athleticism. It was based on his explosiveness and dunking the ball when he was close to the rim and just getting after loose balls. On Tuesday, that was not an athlete. That was a basketball player. You know, it's sort of like the difference when they talk about a baseball pitcher between a thrower and a pitcher. He looked like a polished basketball player against Butler. And I don't think that I had seen that from him for extended minutes before. So you watch that game, and it's against a team, a pretty good team that's considered one of the elite teams in the Atlantic 10 this year, and is, I mean, obviously one of the best coach teams in this region. And to watch him move around the court and use that and show some versatility in his attacking game, I mean, it was really impressive.
we've said about Jeff Robinson that the one stopping him is himself. I mean, his talent is limitless. He can be a big-time basketball player. He has every tool that you would want and just has never been able to put it together for whatever reason, one of the biggest reasons being confidence, of course. We saw him play well against FDU, and the three from the top of the key in the Butler game early was huge for him, I think. And you see that go in, and then all of a sudden, he's a different guy. The biggest play of the game, in my opinion, for Jeff Robinson was the one where he caught the ball on the left wing. He drove towards the baseline side and was kind of getting forced, like the defender was being kind of physical on the drive and giving him contact. And in the past, Jeff Robinson would pick up his dribble there, be forced. You know, he'd let the defender force him closer to the baseline until he ran out of real estate. He'd pick up his dribble, or maybe if he's feeling really squirrely, he'd attempt like a turnaround fadeaway jumper from 12 feet. This time, he leans his shoulder into the guy, drives him all the way to the basket, jumps up, and gets an and one. Uses his height, uses athleticism, uses his length to score on the guy while he's pushing him, and gets the and one. This is the type of thing that Jeff Robinson can do every single game, and there's no reason he shouldn't. Bottom line is, he is a matchup problem. You see the touch on his jump shot when he shoots it with confidence. It's a smooth-looking shot. He can knock it down. The big thing is, will he be aggressive enough to take a guy off a dribble once or twice a game to keep them honest? Will he get those three-point plays to help spur a Xavier run? I mean, those are the types of things they need out of him. And if he does what he did on that play more often, I mean, it doesn't have to be every time he touches the ball. It's one or two times a half. It completely changes this offense. Brad Stevens said after the game, when you look at film and you watch teams and you're trying to evaluate them, as a coach you say, there's certain players that can elevate this team. If they play well, there are certain players that can take this team to that next level. Jeff Robinson is that guy for Xavier, according to Brad Stevens. I have to say, I probably agree with him. I mean, again, Jeff can rebound. He can defend multiple positions. He can protect the rim with his length and shot blocking ability. He can score it inside and out. He's a very versatile piece of this offense, and one that we've almost had to discount because of his constant inconsistency in the past. But if he shows up all of a sudden and plays the way he has in these first two games, this is a completely different Xavier team, and I don't think anyone would argue that. I don't even think the Johnson comparison is a bad one. If you're talking about the way he played in that Butler game, I don't see how you don't agree that you could see similarities in those two games.
You know, when we talk about the confidence that Taylor and Robinson showed, I was just looking at the box score and noticed this. The Muskies took 29 two-point goals in that game. And four of them were effectively in garbage time. So there were 25 two-point field goal attempts while the game was close. Travis Taylor had 10 of them. Jeff Robinson had 8 of them. So that is a team that was finding these guys, was finding them in threatening positions, and they were finishing their shots. And that is an incredibly good sign for this team going forward. I also think let's touch upon Samaje Christen at this point. I thought his effort against Butler, especially when you consider where he came from in the previous 24 to 48 hours, was pretty strong. He had 8 assists, turned the ball over 5 times. A couple of those turnovers were early when he got in the game, probably trying to do too much in front of the national TV lights. He only scored 2 points, and he only got 1 rebound, but he played tough defense, and he's just a guy that every pass he throws seems to have a purpose. He doesn't seem to waste a whole lot of passes. I know that sounds stupid. I just mentioned that he turned the ball over 5 times. But his passes seem to have a level of incisiveness. He does a lot of diagonal passing into the post. I was hoping you could just sort of give people a little bit of background into what his health situation was leading up to the game, and how you think that's and where you think he's going to be when for Saturday's game against Robert Morris, and then for the Thanksgiving tournament.
First of all, what you said about his passing, I actually get what you mean when you say that. I mean, I really do think you bring up a good point there, because I'd even say, like, at least 2 of his turnovers, I know, were he was the reason he made them was because there was a guy open under the basket and he was trying to get an easy two. I mean, there was a very specific purpose for those passes. He was trying to make a play and get a quick bucket. Now, what he probably didn't realize or what might have been the freshman part taking over there was these are big athletic Division I college basketball players you're going against. Those windows are a lot smaller in the college game of what you're trying to throw through. So maybe that's the case on a couple of those early turnovers for sure, but I agree with you. I mean, he goes out and he makes plays when he passes the ball. He's not out there throwing it around the perimeter for no reason. As far as his injury, basically it came down – he was on the court on Monday for practice, but it was, you know, more or less a walk – not a walkthrough, but, I mean, going through drills and stuff like that. He's not banging into guys a lot. He's not really taking shots hardly. He comes back that night – I mean, he couldn't get a shot up to the basket at that point in the day. He came back later that night about 10 o'clock with Travis Steele, assistant coach, and tried to get some shots up. At that point, he was able to make a few free throws, even though it was a struggle to get it there. I mean, there's just so much swelling going on from his elbow down into his forearm that it's very, very sore for him. And he went through practice, or that shooting session with Coach Steele, was able to get some mid-range jumpers and some free throws there. I don't even think he could quite get the ball there from outside the three-point arc. But he wanted to play. The staff knew they could use him. And what you saw from him in the Butler game was toughness. It still bothered him. He definitely wasn't himself. I don't think you'll see another game in his career where he attempts two shots or less. But he still fought through those screens. Butler knew he was out there hurt. And, I mean, they're being physical. They're trying to run him into as many screens as they can. And he's taking them on full bore, running through them, being tough, playing defense and doing his job. And defensively, he was very, very good. I mean, he stayed with Dunham when he was on him and did a good job limiting that potent Butler backcourt that we talked about with their shooting ability. Offensively, eight assists you'll take. I mean, he wasn't himself. He wasn't able to score like he normally would, and he wasn't quite as aggressive as he'd normally be with the ball in his hands. But I still think he'll take that performance from a freshman in his first game, especially when he's injured. And, I mean, honestly, had he taken a jump shot or been fouling on the free throw line, I don't know that there's much of a chance that he could have made it. So it's probably a good game plan for him to kind of look to create and transition and make his plays there and then be a little more subdued in the half-court offense. I thought it was a pretty good performance for Samaje, but it's certainly one of the worst ones we'll see out of him in a Xavier uniform, in my opinion.
Any worries about this injury lingering into the weekend and into next week? Are we going to see him less than 100% on Saturday and then probably back to full go by Thanksgiving?
That would be my guess. My guess would be is he's not 100% yet by Saturday. I mean, we're really only talking about a couple of days. And yeah. Again, he was, you know, running around banging that thing against everybody. I can't imagine he was feeling too great after the game against Butler. So my guess is, yeah. Little bit sore on Saturday, not quite himself, but by the Thanksgiving tournament, he'll be fine.
Well, let's talk, I guess, let's get into sort of the implications of this game. You know, early season game, it's a non-conference game, but it felt like it was a little bit more significant than your average early season non-conference game. First of all, because it was against a conference opponent, because it was against a team with whom Xavier has a history. This is the fifth straight year the Muskies have played Butler. The series is 3-2 in Xavier's favor, with X having won the last three. There have been some incidents and some checkered history between the two. It was an ESPN game. It was part of the kickoff marathon. I thought, I'll give a couple of my thoughts on the game from being up in the upper deck. I thought it was actually, you know, it wasn't a huge crowd, but I thought for it being a Tuesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it was a decent crowd, and I thought it was a very supportive crowd. And I really thought that they got behind the team, and I think it's something we're going to see all year. There was some question about how's the crowd going to react to X this year? How are they going to react to the new faces? If the team struggles, what's it going to look like? Now, we haven't seen the team struggle yet, but it does seem like the crowd has been extremely supportive of the team. And I thought the atmosphere, especially the atmosphere provided by the student section, which for the third straight home date was packed to the gills, was outstanding. And I can certainly understand how a visitor like how a visiting recruit or something like that could really get a good feeling out of that experience. Finally, I just thought it really, the team really played an outstanding game. And I think it opened a lot of eyes. There was a lot of national media watching that game and a lot of people saying, you know, if you were following Twitter during the game as I was, man, there were a lot of national media saying, wow, Xavier again, you know, we probably were too quick in writing them off. So I think maybe this is a game that has that, as I said at the beginning of this aimless rant, had a little bit more significance to it than your average early season November game.
Well, there's no doubt that it had more significance than your typical second game of the season. And whether it mattered to Xavier or what Xavier is going to be or not, I don't know. But it mattered in the national scope without question, because like you mentioned, there's all these national pundits who have been talking about how down Xavier is going to be this year. And again, finishing ninth in the A-10, which is really a joke when you think about it. I mean, Xavier is never and will never finish that low in this conference. I think a lot of people had their eyes opened. Xavier recruited these players, and many of them were more highly touted than Xavier greats of the past. The Justin Dolmans, the David Wests even, you know, James Posey's, guys like that. I mean, you're talking about Justin Martin, D. Davis, Samaje Kristen. I mean, you talk about Paul Dougherty's column that he wrote today about how this Xavier team is basically filled with no-namers and they're not like the Xavier teams of old that we've seen. And I'm sitting there thinking, these guys were recruited at a higher level than any of those guys. And D. Davis brought that point up in the post-game press conference when everyone's constantly asking his question, did you feel you were an underdog? Are you glad that this do you think this team's going to be better than everyone else thought? Are you using that as a chip on your shoulder? No. Like, we didn't think we were an underdog to Butler. D. Davis said, we were recruited to be on scholarship too. Why can't we make a few shots once in a while? Like, that was his quote, and he's right. People were excited when Xavier landed Justin Martin. People were excited when Xavier landed D. Davis. Jeff Robinson was committed to Purdue at one point. The kid had talent. Like, these guys still have talent, and they were still recruited to be good basketball players at Xavier. They're not going to be the team that they would have been with Lyons and Wells, but this team can still be good.
Well, I can tell you that my blood pressure dropped significantly when I stopped reading Paul Dougherty altogether, because I don't think he knows to the slightest bit what he's talking about. But that's my media meta criticism being over. All right, we had a Twitter correspondent ask me a question today. I just want you to weigh in briefly, and then we'll close the book on the first Butler game of the season. And the question was, is Xavier this good or is Butler this bad?
Both.
Your response.
Both. And I don't think Xavier's this good or Butler's this bad. I think Xavier's better than people thought. Not quite as good as people are thinking they are now. There is an overreaction going on because of this game. Xavier still has plenty that needs to be proven. I mean, we're sitting here talking about how good Jeff Robinson, how good Travis Taylor, how good Justin Martin was. Well, none of those guys have really done this in the past before. There's no track record that says they're going to continue to play this way. And there certainly are issues with the Butler offense, and really, Butler's offense wasn't even their problem in this game when you look at the stats. It was their defense. Their defense, which is usually great under Brad Stevens, was soft, and they let Xavier shoot 50%. I mean, that very rarely happens to a Butler defense. I think that there's some things that Butler needs to work out, and they will work some of them out, and then there's some just problems with their offense that I mentioned earlier because...
Well, they lost Krishan Hopkins.
They don't have a point guard.
They had a four-star point guard recruit come in that quit the team before the season started. And, I mean Alex Barlow, who's a walk-on, that was a pretty good player at Moeller, but I mean, probably not a guy they expect to be using, got... what, 11 minutes in that game at guard.
With all due respect to everyone listening, Alex Barlow and Chase DeGaulle don't belong on that court yesterday. I mean, they just don't. They're not good enough. So, I mean, Butler's got some issues of their own, and I don't think they're quite as good as everyone said. That I'll leave it at this. Xavier will be in the top five of the A-10 this year. I mean, there's no way they won't be. So I think to answer that question again, Xavier is good, not as good as some people are going to say they are because of that win. Butler is not quite as good as people expected them to be, but still better than everyone's going to think they are after that win.
I think we all wanted to believe, or at least I did, you know, what you and Brian Snow and some of the other commentators were saying, which is that, yeah, you know, this offseason, a lot of bad things happened, but they still have a lot of talent. And I think everyone needed to see it. And scoring 117 points in a glorified intramural game wasn't really that. But doing it against Butler is. I mean, that showed a lot.
It's legit.
And they're going to be bumps in the road. And you know, how this team is going to respond to a hostile road environment is anyone's guess at this point. But certainly you see that, and you see the way they played, and they did it with Samaje Christen maybe operating at 50% of his capacity and yep. without Isaiah Fillmore. And Fillmore, you know, may or may not be an impact guy early in the season, but I mean, you got to feel pretty good about where the team is at this point. Musketeers will be back in action next on Saturday afternoon, 2:00. They'll be playing Robert Morris team that's had some success in the past 5 years. They've been to the NCAA tournament a couple times. They sort of made the career of Mike Rice as a Rutgers now, right?
Yes.
And but this year they've had kind of a struggle start. They got really cleaned out their first two games by, I think, Lehigh and Ryder. And then just recently did get a blowout win over an A-10 team, but it was Fordham, so anyone's guess. You see anything about this team that gives you any pause going into Saturday's game?
It's all about keeping up with the Joneses in this one. I mean, they've got two really good players.
Oh, that is a bad pun on it, like a James Bond movie level, Rick.
It was. Yeah, I thought
you've got that written down, don't you?
No, but I thought it was pretty high level. I was pretty proud of the corniness of it, honestly, because that's not usually my MO. That's more of an Evan Daniels, Brian Snow type of deal. But you know, I'm trying to get with the company way and come up with corny lines of my own. So I thought that was a good start. But in all seriousness, I do really like a couple players they've got. Velton Jones being one of them, their guard. He's their leading scorer, but he's also a playmaker. I mean, he sets everybody else up. He gets the ball into the right places. He finds guys. Little out of control at times, turns it over. But I like him a lot. And then Lucky Jones, their wing, is another guy who can score it, shoot a little bit from the outside, athletic rebounds. So I think there are some challenges there. Robert Morris certainly isn't a team you're just going to roll over. But at the same time, I think it's another game that Xavier's going to be in a good position to win. You play defense the way you did against Butler, and you have absolutely zero problems winning this game by 10 to 15 points.
Then after the Robert Morris game on Saturday, the Muskies will decamp to Anaheim for the exempt tournament. They'll play the University of the Pacific on Thanksgiving Day. I believe tip-off is 2 o'clock. It's 11 o'clock a.m. Pacific time. And then the results of those games will determine opponents and times for the games Friday and Sunday. I don't know that we'll have another podcast before then, so any teams interest you in that exempt tournament?
I don't know that they interest me or any of them jump out at me, but the big thing is that it'll be interesting to see this team on the road. Or I mean, it's not technically road games, but you're playing away from home. You're staying in a hotel over a few nights. These guys have to be mature. They have to come back a couple days in a row and play good basketball. That's going to be the interesting thing to me. The other interesting thing is you've got a short bench. A lot of guys playing a lot of minutes, especially your guards, D and Samaje. How do those guys look when they have to come back a couple days later and play? You know, those. One time you're playing at night, the next day you're playing in the afternoon, whatever the case may be. Those tournaments are always wacky. So how do they respond to just the change of scenery, the adversity that comes with those tournaments will be interesting to me. I think they're going to need to be a mature team led by their seniors. They need Jeff Robinson to be good. They need Travis Taylor to be good. And I think they should be in good shape. I mean, they could very legitimately win this thing. And if you told me that Xavier started this season 6-0, man, I mean, I think anyone would take that as far as the fan base goes.
Will the University of the Pacific be starting Michael Olowokandi? And if so, how does that affect the matchups?
What?
Well, he's the only guy I've ever heard of that went to the University of the Pacific.
I was going to say, where is this coming from? They have a guy named Tim Thomas on the roster. I thought you were going to ask about him.
Come on, man, the candy man.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm a big Michael Holloway. I can't even say that seriously. But well done. I mean,
do you think Michael Holloway candy weighs 400 pounds at this point? First of all, is my question.
Oh gosh, are we going over under on that? What do you have? Are you going over 400?
Oh, he is closer to 4 bills than 3 bills.
No question. He's definitely over 350. That's not even in doubt. I'm gonna say he's under 4 though. I'm going like 370.
Jared Lorenzen
and him are at the same weight right now.
Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, that I would believe that. I saw
J Lo's my guy.
I saw the hefty lefty out a few weeks ago. He is he is not small. So let's talk briefly. Get back up to speed with recruiting. We talked about Brandon Randolph earlier. We will have a more in-depth discussion of his game and how it fits into the recruiting strategy for Xavier if and when he does commit after this sojourn to Columbia, Missouri. But today, I believe, is the first day of the signing period, right, Rick? Any bumps in the road with Kamal?
No, I mean, we still haven't heard whether or not his LOI is in, but there's nothing to be worried about as far as I know. I think they had to, you know, get it signed and then fax it over to his parents and then get that signed, whatever. It's always a process with these things, especially if the kids are at a prep school or whatever. So I haven't heard if it's officially in yet. It was supposed to be coming in tonight at some point, possibly while we're recording this. And I'll update that on the board, but no, I don't expect any hiccups with Kamal Richards' recruitment or him signing on with Xavier.
It never ceases to amaze me that in the $100 million industry, if not $1 billion industry, that is college football and college basketball, that we still use fax machine.
I mean,
why not send a Western Union telegraph or by carrier? Send in your LOI by carrier pigeon. I mean, it's just. I guess it gives Nick Saban an excuse to have some hot-looking girl manning the fax machine on the Alabama website like they got in trouble a few years ago for. But
and really, when it comes down to it, that's what we're all here for, what Nick Saban wants to do.
So let's talk about, you know, I had a number of questions to ask you about where you saw 2013-2014 going. But it was all predicated on Brandon Randolph being in the fold. So let's
first of all, hold on. What are you breaking right now? What's going on over there? Are you being bombed?
I just dropped a water bottle.
But all right, okay, we're good. We're good.
So if we assume the Randolph's in the fold, which I'm going to regret having made that assumption. X is going to have, I believe, 11 guys on scholarship for next season. Plus Eric Stenger, who isn't guaranteed a scholarship for next year. Do you see the Muskies keeping that? Do you see the Muskies looking for someone else in the 2013 class, or is it a pretty solid bet that they're going to sit on that for 2014?
I'd say it's still to be determined, because they're definitely not going to stop recruiting right now. I mean, there's guys still out there. There's names that will still pop up. There's decommitments that will happen. There's transfers that could come in. They're not going to stop recruiting. But what they are is, I think, I can't speak for them, but if I were them, I'd be content with what you have in this class. Because, again, you have Matt Stainbrook, you have Miles Davis, you have Jalen Reynolds all coming in next year to help you out. You've got a lot of pieces. Now you add Brandon Randolph, which adds some more depth to your backcourt and another scorer that can create off the bounce, which is huge because you've got Miles Davis, a knockdown shooter, already added to your backcourt.
Well, and another thing is that 2014 class has an excellent reputation, especially in this part of the country. And the Muskies, I think, only lose two guys that following year. It'd be Fillmore and Cantino that would drop off the radar at that point. So they may want to have an extra scholarship or two for that to throw around in that class. So that's another thing that's out there.
That's something that we've talked about a couple times in this podcast. You know, they're really close. They've already got Melvin Swift, and they're really close on a guy like Shane Hall. So you take two forwards that are somewhat similar, although Shane Hall's more of a power guy, whereas Melvin Swift's a little more of a combo guy. You could probably play them together at the three and the four. You might want something else in that class. You might need a point guard if Samaje is about to leave, whatever the case may be. So I definitely think they'd like to hold at least one scholarship back for 2014.
And we just mentioned Chris Cantino. Article in the Enquirer this week by Shannon Russell detailing his trials and travails with trying to obtain clearance to play this year. Can you sort of break down what's going on? I mean, I realize that this is not a guy that's probably that would be playing a big role this year anyway, but I think everyone's kind of confused and trying to parse what his situation is at this point.
Well, you're right. Everyone is, including myself. I mean, really, what the hell's going on with the NCAA? I have no idea. I don't understand how this process is healthy for anyone involved. I don't understand why they make it that way. If he will be cleared or not, I have no clue. But as far as what he would bring if he was cleared, I can't see it being much. He didn't look good in practice. You know, he's a guy who's behind because he got here late, and then he was injured. He's now got a finger injury too that's holding him back a little bit. He's been slow to pick up the offense and the defensive systems. I don't think he's a guy that's going to help them much this year, other than if they got into a situation where they had an injury and they needed another body. I mean, he is 6'7", pretty strong, good athleticism, and a little bit of skill. So he could definitely help. I just don't know that he would get much playing time on this team if they don't have an injury of some sort. So it might work out in his favor that he's redshirted. That being said, he'll be in a war next year to get minutes too. So a lot of people are asking, you know, why'd they take Cantino? Why would they do this? Did they just do it because they panicked? Probably to an extent. I mean, they had a lot of scholarships to fill, and he only had 1 year left. A 6'7 guy with some athleticism, some skill level. I mean, I think it was a decent risk. It turns out that they probably didn't need him that bad. And now, of course, the whole thing with the NCAA has just made it a circus. But if he was ready, it made sense.
Just to unpack one thing there, the critical thing to understand is that because of some arcane NCAA rule, Cantino only has 1 year of eligibility. He doesn't have two the way that most junior college graduates would have because of his age. So his choices really are to wait for clearance this year, play this year, and then be out of eligibility, or to redshirt this year and have next year when he would be eligible. You know, it seems to me that if the staff brought him in, that scholarship's probably going to be tied up for both years anyway. So it's just a matter of what makes the most sense for the kid, what makes the most sense for the team.
Yeah, and I think one of the things Mac mentioned, that if he burned his eligibility this year, if he does get cleared by the NCAA, he's not going to be ready to graduate at the end of this year, and he's probably not going to help the team much this year. So he basically was brought to Xavier to sit on a bench and not graduate, and now he's off scholarship at the end of the year. So redshirting him would at least give him the opportunity to finish up his playing career at the same time that he should be finishing up his degree. And that was something that Max said was kind of important, you know, and something that Xavier wants to be about. So that's a good thing by the university, and it makes sense. So I don't think we'll see Chris Cantino this season.
Well, that that's one of the critical issues that we're looking at when we talk about the roster situation. Any other issues floating around right now, Rick, that you want to bring up, since this is our first in-season podcast? Anything that you've seen or heard in your as you've been covering the team over the last week or so that that sort of is a wild card and doesn't fit into what we've already been talking about?
No, I mean, there's not really any like lingering injuries or something that people aren't really aware of. I think most of that stuff in this day and age gets out pretty quickly. The one thing I would say is Isaiah Fillmore, the expectations for him need to be limited, and they aren't. It's my fault that they aren't right now, because I expected him to possibly lead the team in the scoring.
Oh, we both said that
coming into this year
when we fielded that question in the listener call-in show.
Right, and well, I mean, the benefit I had was watching him several days of practice and open gym, although it was somewhat limited because he was out with the knee injury. But I mean, I really expected him to score well and be a big part of this team. Right now, I think he'd have trouble getting minutes. He's a little slow. He's been working. The one thing that was actually kind of nice about these 3 days of him, or 3 games of him being suspended, is he's been able to go hard. Other guys, they practice short. They're trying to keep him fresh. With Fillmore, he's practiced, and then he's gone back out on the court with the coaching staff and worked on his explosiveness, worked on getting his knee back to 100%. It's not there yet, and it's not going to be for a little while. And more importantly, I don't think his conditioning is quite there. He looks overweight to me. I mean, he was not this big last year, and as a result, I think his lift and his foot speed has been hurt by that, and it's gonna cost him inside a little bit, especially when it comes to rebounding, trying to score in the post. The other thing I do see is that this offense that we've been talking about with all this screening and cutting and ball movement isn't great for him necessarily, because he's a guy who, he's kind of got an odd game. He's very crafty. He's kind of an isolation guy. I mean, he's got sort of an NBA forwards game, to where he likes to get you in that short corner or on the baseline there and isolate and take some time, make a move, and hit a step back jumper or fade away, or get you on a fake and go under you for a score.
Kind of like a LaMarcus Aldridge type.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, he's only 6'7", and shoots it better than Aldridge does. Shoots a little differently than Aldridge does, I guess I would say. But, yeah, I mean, similar concept there for sure. So I think it's going to be an adjustment trying to get him in, because he doesn't quite fit in with all of this yet. But I think he will get there. By December, I think he'll really kind of – you'll start to see him help the team more. By January, I think he'll be close to 100%. And that's when things really get interesting, because if you add an Isaiah Fillmore that's as good as we expected him to be before the year, this team has some great potential and pretty good depth in the post. And you think this team is so thin, but you look at their post especially, and it might be one of the better post rotations that Mac has had.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring up a couple quick fire observations that I had from the Butler game. The first one relates to that sort of post rotation. Is the thing that I noticed the most on defense is that while Xavier struggled a little bit to keep Butler off the offensive glass, I think they conceded like 11 offensive rebounds. One thing that I think you brought this up was that the bigs were far more active defensively this year than they were last year. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that when you have a front court, say, of Martin, Robinson, Taylor, you're talking about three guys, they're pretty quick and can get lateral and can get up and down a lot better, obviously, than having somebody like Kenny Freeze last year, who, I mean, for all the good he did the Musketeers in his 4 years, would never be confused with Usain Bolt. So for a lot of reasons. that's maybe a rather extreme comparison.
Good Lord.
But yeah, that was one thing that I did notice, is that those guys did get out a little bit more quickly, and they seemed to really harass the other team a lot more. So I'm hoping that maybe that heralds the end of the classic European stretch four hitting six threes against the Muskies in every league game this year.
Yeah, I don't think you'll see that. I agree with you on that one. That's a good point.
The other one was, I don't know who was responsible for this, but I thought that the stadium giveaway for the Butler game, those styrofoam sticks with the LED lights in them, were pretty much the coolest stadium arena giveaway I think they've ever done at Cintas Center. I hope people keep bringing them to games and they give out more of them, because those were pretty cool during the pregame warmups. And then the last thing was that for me, probably one of the indelible images of the year, and I would love to find a picture of this, was Brad Redford giving the Heisman to that dude from Butler on his last three that made it 60-40, like giving him a full open armed shove after his ball fake right in front of the ref. And that was pretty awesome. It just shows the level of confidence that Redford has right now, that once he got the ball, he was literally willing to do whatever it took to get himself that centimeter of space. That's the first time I've seen Redford shoot with that kind of confidence and with that kind. It just is. He's so dialed in right now. And that's another huge offensive weapon for the Musketeers. And if he is going to be in that situation where every night he's a danger to hit five or six threes, teams are going to have to account for that, and that's going to take them out of their typical defensive game plan.
Well, have you I tell you what, this is one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the Butler, and really the FDU game too, because D's doing it as well, but Samaje especially in the Butler game. Watch his eyes in transition. He scans the court to find where Redford is immediately, and he looks for any opening to get the ball to Redford in transition. I mean, I remember the one time he started on sort of the right side of the lane, extended, drove down, got to about the free throw line, and then kicked it out behind him and to his left to Redford on the left wing, even though he was slightly covered. And when Redford didn't shoot, he got kind of mad at it and was like, "Pull. You know, let go of that. If you're open, shoot the ball. Even if you're not open, shoot the ball." I mean, this team is so excited about the way Brad Redford is playing. And if you don't feel good for Brad Redford right now, you're not human. Honestly, I mean, the kid has been through a lot. He had a really tough year last year, and I don't think he was having much fun. But there is no question that he's having fun right now, and that's good to see just for a guy that's put in a lot of work and is a good guy by all accounts. And anytime I've had to deal with him, I really liked, you mentioned the stiff arm, I really liked he did the little James Harden celebration after that three coming back down the court, which I thought was fun.
He's confident. His teammates have confidence in him. Last year, neither of those things were true. So this is, I mean, we're getting back to him being on the same form he was in his sophomore year when the team was really looking for him off the bench to help out and to provide, you know, his last year of playing, I guess last season, they're, with the amount of possessions that Lyons and Holloway and then Wells were using, there just weren't that many shots for him, and he never got into any kind of game rhythm, still struggling to get back from that knee injury. And so it's great to see him. I mean, if he keeps up anything close to this, Ken Pomeroy's offensive rating calculator is going to explode, or they're just going to have an infinity next to his name, because I mean, he scores in multiples of threes, and against FDU, he had six threes in like 12 minutes or something like that. So hopefully we continue to see 17 minutes. I'm sorry. Hopefully he continues to be that hot, and it adds a dimension to this team that is unique. I mean, you talk about Rodney Clark, not quite the all around game that Clark has, but certainly can be his match from beyond the 3-point arc.
Yeah. In a game of horse, my money's going on Redford in that, by the way. I've seen it too much. There's no way I bet against Redford in any game of horse against anyone you can pick out. I've just seen him make too many shots at practice. On the giveaway, the glow sticks you were talking about, I thought that was really cool too. Have you seen that done anywhere else? Because
no.
I was trying to think. I thought it had to be something that was kind of popular, but I can't think of anywhere else I've seen that.
I that was a first for me. I don't know, but I mean, I don't watch a whole lot of NBA, so. It may be something that some of the NBA, but maybe that's something we can ask some of the Cintas Center staff the next time we're down there and see whose idea that was. Because whoever it was, it definitely had a pretty cool effect. And I only wish that it had been, you know, a night game when they had the full 10,000
in their seat. Yep.
Because it would have been crazy, but it still was a pretty impressive effect, especially from the student section.
Recruiting information and glow stick breakdown. MusketeerReport.com. We do it all.
And Michael Olowa Candy.
And Michael Olowa Candy references. There you go. That I think that puts this one to bed unless you have anything else relevant.
Nope. That is edition number 11. I think both Rick and I will be at the Robert Morris game. We may, if we can figure out how to do it technologically, record something short right after the game. But if not, if we don't get anything recorded next week, which is possible, given the holiday, hope all of our listeners have a great Thanksgiving.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that does it for this edition of the Dana and Victory podcast. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.